Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, you may press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to your host for today's conference, Dr. Marcy Darnovsky of the Center for Genetics and Society. You may begin.
Hi, and thank you everyone for joining us this morning on the West Coast, and afternoon for the East Coasters. We're going to be hearing today from three progressive, pro-choice healthcare, medical, and policy experts about some of the serious flaws in Proposition 71, the California Stem Cell Initiative. Their voices are part of a growing chorus of opposition that includes many others: women's health and civil society leaders, science and medical experts, bioethicists, other scholars, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, and business writers. These are people who support embryonic stem cell research, but who oppose Proposition 71. Our focus today will be on a number of points, including these key ones: threats to women's health and the public health, Prop 71's reckless dismissal of established safeguards in key areas, and the unwarranted control and privileged role that the proposition would give to the commercial biotechnology sector. The presentations will be under 30 minutes, and then we'll be taking questions. I'm going to now turn it over to our first speaker, Deborah Berger, the president of the California Nurses Association.
Hello. Today I'd like to talk a little bit about the unfair advantage that the no on the Progressive Alliance against Prop 71, in that the Yes campaign has over $20 million to purchase ads and get their message out to the voters of the state of California. We're concerned because we believe that this initiative has a national implications on both the public scrutiny of this institute that's going to be set up, as well as the unfair advantage being given to the biotech and pharmaceutical industry because they are now going to be publicly funded. The California Nurses Association represents 59,000 registered nurses all over the state of California, and we have passed landmark patient protection legislation, as well as advocate for patients in our communities, and we felt that we had to speak up against Prop 71 because this legislation will do grave harm to both our patients and the community at large, and we're very concerned that the public get that message. We are pro-choice, and we are for stem cell research. We can see the value in it because nurses take care of patients in the community, at the bedside, in the schools, and we feel that we will be severely restricted in our ability to provide that care because of the health care crisis that would be caused as a result of the funding of this initiative. We feel that it's critical for the voters to hear both sides, and that message is not currently getting out there. We know that there are ads being run by the Yes campaign that are using people's true compassion for their fellow citizens to unfairly advantage this campaign while mainly hiding the true nature of this, which is to use public funding for private corporations to profit from this. They're asking the citizens of California basically to put up money to front the biotech and drug companies in using the research to make many new technologies available, which they will charge the citizens for. And so we're getting billed twice, in a sense, because we're putting up the money for this industry, and then we're going to have to buy the same treatments that they develop from this. So they're double dipping, I think, into what will be charged for these treatments if they even come to fruition. We think that the voters deserve a debate on the issues, and right now they aren't getting the information so that there can be a debate on that topic. We've asked people to sign on to the website Alliance to be able to get the information, but trying to get that information out there has been severely hampered by the funding for the No campaign. We're concerned about Prop 72 aggravating the disparities in the current healthcare system, and we feel that it's going to weaken the protections for women who participate in the research, and it could also permit the wealthy corporate giants to hijack the benefits of the publicly funded research, and that's why we're very, very concerned about this initiative. Thank you.
Deborah, thanks very much. Our next speaker is noted medical geneticist, Dr. Paul Billings. Paul?
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to participate in this conference. I just want to say that I did my first experiment on stem cells at Harvard Medical School 25 years ago, and have been working in this area for the last 25 years with a great deal of interest. Stem cells are diverse and interesting from a developmental biological point of view, and we hope that they can help make new tissues and organs and treatments that some would say would create ghoulish spare parts, but we hope that they will help the ill and the suffering, and we need to support this research more fully, and this is all a laudable goal. But let's be perfectly clear about this. Chances that any biological biotech target will become an approved therapy is about 1 in 5,000 or less. Embryonic stem cells become tumors much more easily than they become cures. If Proposition 71 passes, we're more likely in a few years to have a constitutional right to worthless, unapproved therapy and to tumors than we are to something that we want. I do not want the Constitution of California sullied by this kind of amendment. Secondly, there are about 30,000 or more stem cell treatments currently going on in this country every year using bone marrow and cord blood-derived stem cells. These are helping people now. We need to fund and extend this work. These cells can do many new things, and they can do them now, and they are useful now, and they will be more useful in the future. This is the best near-term hope for families in need now, and these cells don't produce the tumors that embryonic stem cells do. Third point, we have a federal process that sets priorities in science and science funding, identifies and funds worthy research, helps with commercialization, provides transparency and oversight and protections for the public. This is the system that gave you the success of the Human Genome Project coming in under budget and early. This is the system that gave us the new treatments like Gleevec for cancer. And this is the system that has given us a remarkable project in progress in neuroscience recently. If the politicians in Washington, D.C. are interfering with this in a deleterious way, we need to throw the bums out. We need to vote them away. States should not be altering their constitutions to fund individual science projects. It's grotesque. Think about if every state had a pet project like this, and it's a travesty. This is an extreme departure from a admittedly not perfect but tried and true system. With the conflicts and the court cases that are likely to result from all this, I think this is going to slow things down for the people who need the benefits of this kind of work most. Next point. In the last two decades, $3 billion was the entire NIH budget that funded all the work on cancer and heart disease and mental illness. What Proposition 71 wants to spend now on unnecessary infrastructure and on one rather risky research project. This is being proposed in a bankrupt state where needy, sick people people and children are going underserved. I don't think that's good public policy or good science policy. My final point is this. Science has become increasingly commercial. There is an academic industrial complex that's alive and well in California. And there are many entrepreneurial scientists with lots of conflicts of interest out there working. That's the facts, and it's not all bad. But let's be realistic. Ownership of these cells, the processes that are used to make them useful, the treatments, is already murky and disputed and is only going to get worse. The treatments that arise from this will be costly if they're produced at all. I do not think that the taxpayers of the state of California will get a financial return from Proposition 71. I do think that the scientists and their funders might reap some near-term returns at the taxpayers' expense if 71 passes. So for these reasons and many others, we need to protect the interests of the needy of the state of California. We need to protect the California Constitution, which is a wonderful document. And to do this, we need to vote no on 71 and yes on a regime change in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much.
Paul, thank you. And we'll now hear from Francine Coito, who sat on the California Advisory Committee on Human Cloning as a women's reproductive health authority. Francine?
Good day. I have spent the last 30 years working to improve women's health internationally and domestically, and specifically ensuring their access to reproductive health services and new reproductive technologies. Over the course of the past decade, I've played a role in the development of the abortion pill and emergency contraception. I have a daughter who is missing part of a chromosome, so I personally know the lure of potential cures. I strongly support public funding for embryonic stem cell research, and am outraged by the Bush administration's continued use of personal politics to trump science. Most pertinent to today's conversation, I have spent the last 5 years on the state of California's Advisory Committee on Human Cloning, learning that embryonic stem cell research holds promise, that it is a powerful technology that could be used for good or for harm, and that it should move forward only with the highest level of transparency, regulation, and enforcement. What I learned from serving on this expert committee has made me an active opponent of Proposition 71. This proposed law does not protect nor benefit the citizens of California. Instead, it creates grave legal and ethical concerns. I'd like to list a couple of my concerns. First of all, Prop 71 fails to provide the high level of regulation, monitoring, and enforcement needed for this new research. Important ethical research issues regarding women's health, the harvesting of eggs, and human reproductive cloning will be left to rules interpreted by, and in some cases created by, those with vested interests. There are no regulatory controls to prevent a cloned embryo from being implanted in a woman's uterus to produce a child. This would be illegal in California, but not in Nevada or Oregon or just about any other state in the country. What is there to prevent someone from taking the technology over the border? And what safeguards would prevent the harvesting of cells and tissues from fetuses at later stages of development? Who is going to protect the rights and the health of the women who will be needed to produce the eggs required for the research? Rather than addressing these issues, Prop 71 flouts regulation and throws decades of ethical oversight out of the window. When our advisory committee recommended allowing therapeutic cloning, it was with the proviso that the research be carefully regulated. Proposition 71 proponents promise oversight, but in fact, the initiative insulates the newly created institute from public or legislative accountability. The initiative is rife with carefully crafted language that exempts the research from existing ethical and scientific standards. It categorically states that stem cell researchers will not be bound by current and future laws and regulations or by NIH guidelines, and it gives them the right to modify and change existing state and federal regulations and guidelines dealing with informed consent, controls on research involving humans, and limitations on experimenting with embryos. I want want to give you some concrete examples, and I'm going to read directly from the initiative. For example, regarding medical standards, and I quote, "The Institute will develop its own scientific and medical standards to carry out the specific controls and intent of the Institute," end quote. Regarding informed consent, "The Institute will establish its own standards, which initially shall be based on the NIH standards, but can be modified to adapt to the mission and objectives of the Institute," end quote. Proposition 71 essentially eliminates all existing ethical controls. Most egregious is the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee. Charged with distributing the funds and controlling all the functions of this research, this oversight committee is anything but independent. It's made up of academic scientists whose careers depend on the research, biotech companies whose financial pockets depend on the research, and disease advocacy groups whose loved ones' health and lives depend on the research. The conflict of interest is inherent in the structure of the committee. To quote Daniel Sarwitz in this Monday's LA Times, he states, "The resulting level of institutional conflict of interest reveals an extraordinary hubris among the initiative's authors." I couldn't agree more. Research using human embryos requires more, not less, safeguards. When insufficient protections are guaranteed to patients up front, history shows we all pay a higher price in the long run. Prop 71 does not afford us those protections. The same combination of overzealousness and disdain for subject protections has led to serious abuses in the past. Willowbrook, Tuskegee, the involuntary sterilization of hundreds of women, thalidomide, and most recently, the unnecessary death of gene therapy patient Jesse Selinger should remind us of the possibility of abuses. Prop 71 disregards the fundamental processes of our democracy and our 30-year tradition of scientific ethics and patient safety. In my opinion, the authors of Proposition 71 have passed up the opportunity to craft a measure that would have moved stem cell research forward quickly and responsibly. Other countries, including Canada and the UK, have established strict regulations that protect the public interest and women's health and satisfy stem cell research scientists. Prop 71 could have used those models, but instead, it asks us Californians to trust the fox to guide the hen house and pay for the fox with our own money. In addition to these concerns about the lack of regulation, I worry that Proposition 71, instead of speeding up the progress towards cures, will in fact slow it down. Dr. Billings has already addressed this. Scientific advances happen most quickly in open, transparent systems, one in which there is competition amongst the greatest number of scientists and when the scientists are motivated to share and publish their findings often and as soon as possible. In science, in particular in a field as nascent as stem cell research, no one can predict who will make the important discoveries nor what the innovations might be. By throwing a lot of money to a narrowly defined group of researchers, Proposition 71 may well stifle competition. And it most definitely removes the incentive to openly share scientific findings, further limiting the opportunity for outsiders outside of California, and indeed outside the clique of insiders in California who receive Proposition 71 funds. While the proposition will definitely benefit a finite group of researchers and biotech companies in California, it may well disenfranchise those in other states and other countries. The advocates who are lured by the hope of new cures soon should seriously take note of this. There is no doubt that a much better road leading to useful discoveries is that already paved by the existing network and culture of NIH-funded research. Moreover, driven by a sense of urgency, one should seriously question an initiative which proposes to set up a whole new infrastructure and bureaucracy and build buildings. $300 million is allocated by Proposition 71 to building facilities. Just how long will that take? In sum, Proposition 71 is the wrong way to fund the science. Science requires flexibility and the ability to change direction as new discoveries emerge. The right way to pursue embryonic stem cell research is to change the policy at the federal level and maintain careful regulation and control. Stem cell research is too important to botch. And if we are to spend scarce public dollars on stem cell research, we have an obligation to do it right. California has been a leader in the United States. We were the first state to outlaw reproductive human cloning and the first to pass a law allowing therapeutic cloning. But along with this leadership comes a responsibility to carefully regulate the research, protect against the misuse of science either to clone humans or engage in genetic modifications of children. We don't need to build new buildings and set up a costly new bureaucracy that will be unaccountable and stifle competition. We need legislative and administrative action that's deliberate, flexible, and responsive to new scientific discoveries. The California legislature was considering allocating resources towards stem cell research before it was waylaid by the false promises being made by the proponents of 71. The truth is, we cannot afford Prop 71, not financially, not ethically, and not even in terms of time. As Dr. Billings has said, the most cost-effective and time-efficient way to progress towards possible cures is to put the research back in the scientific mainstream and ensure that it benefits from all the scientific resources the NIH and the U.S. has to offer. Thanks.
Francine, thank you very much. This is Marcy Darnofsky again, and just to wrap up these presentations and summarize some of the key points that the three speakers hit on, talking about the healthcare costs in terms of existing people who would have money drained from healthcare programs, disparities that could be created if any successful treatments are too expensive to be affordable, the dangers of scientific research driven by a profit motive, the risks to public health without sufficient protections in areas like informed consent and protection of research subjects. Also mentioning the costs, the taxpayers, we're looking at $200 million a year for 30 years to pay for this, and the dangers to women's health specifically if an egg market were to be created in which young women and poor women felt economic inducements to provide their eggs in risky procedures. We also heard from the speakers that we have recommendations for moving forward quickly but responsibly in stem cell research, that we do have models of responsible oversight and regulatory control that would allow the research to move ahead while safeguarding public health, while assuring appropriate public oversight. So with that, I want to see if there are questions, and the operator, I think, will help us take questions. Okay,
thank you. We will now begin the formal question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be announced prior to asking your question. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment, please. San Francisco Magazine, you may ask your question.
Hi, I just needed some clarification from Paul Billings on some of the statistics you gave.
Yep.
The $3 billion was the entire NIH.
That used to be the entire NIH budget within the last 2 decades.
I can't remember when
it got above $3 billion, but it was within the last 2 decades that it started to rise. It's now about somewhere
between
20
and 30. But if you add up the budget of the past 2 decades every year for 20 years.
Say it again.
Tell me how you got to $3
billion. The annual budget of the NIH
is like 26.
But what I'm saying is that about within the last 2 decades, it was the entire budget was $3 billion. The NIH budget has expanded enormously over the last 2 decades.
Okay.
So all I'm saying is that it wasn't so long ago that the whole NIH budget, federal expenditure for research on everything, was $3 billion. This project proposes $3 billion for one project, and
right.
it's unnecessary.
It.
That's the point.
And then the 1 in 5,000 chance of any one target becoming a therapy.
Right. That's currently from the pharmaceutical industry. Basically, that's the chance that any discovery basic discovery of a target for treatment becomes an approved pharmaceutical. The chance is about 1 in 5,000 that any particular target actually ends up FDA approved. And all I'm saying is that the chances for embryonic stem cells are no better and probably worse than that.
Right, I got it. Okay, I think that's it for now. Thanks.
Antonio Regalado of Wall Street Journal, you may ask your question.
Hi, this is a message for Francine. I think you were talking about the Prop 71 as a kind of race to the bottom in terms of oversight, but my understanding when it comes to embryo research, right now the oversight is in the hands of the fertility clinics and or the universities where they work in their internal review board, so I don't see how things will get any worse than they are already in terms of the fox guarding the hen house. I mean, they're already in charge of their own ethical decisions when it comes to embryos. In what way does Proposition 71 make that any worse?
As you said, they have to respond to their review boards, and all the scientists that are getting any kind of NIH funding have to adhere to all of the kinds of NIH guidelines and regulations that are in place. And what this proposition does is essentially say that those guidelines and those regulations will not have to be adhered to. So it only worsens the problem. I agree with you that we need a tremendous amount more regulation, even if particularly in the case of the infertility treatments. But those at least are being covered in terms of the human research, human subjects and informed consent guidelines. They have to adhere to those. What we're doing here in Proposition 71 is taking it, essentially institutionalizing the fact that it will be a complete free-for-all and that there will not need to even follow those basic guidelines.
This is Marcy Darnowski. Just one further comment is just we would like to emphasize just how dramatic a departure Prop 71 is in terms of the amount of money that is allocated, in terms of the departure from normal procedures for allocating research funds and making decisions about research priorities, and in terms of allowing a governing body that will be set up that has no independent or disinterested parties on it to override many years of existing experience with safeguards and protections in key areas.
I would like to also add, Marcy, this is Francine again, and continuing with the question that was just asked. The other part that's disturbing and that's specific to embryonic stem cell research is that in the infertility clinics, women who are giving up or producing eggs are doing so for a very personal desire to have an offspring. When we go to harvesting eggs for the sake of research, there is no longer that direct gain on the part of the person who is submitting to taking the drugs in order to produce the eggs. And this is a real problem. In fact, in Canada and in the UK, they have made it illegal to harvest eggs simply for the purpose of research and not for a direct outcome of trying to produce your own offspring.
Is there any follow-up? Megan Garvey of Los Angeles Times, you may ask your question.
I had a question for Dr. Billing. You talked about potential problems with states getting pet projects called it a travesty and said there would be conflicts in court cases. Could
right.
you talk a little bit about what you meant by that?
Well, I mean, think about this. Let's say that, California amends its constitution to have stem cell research and the right to stem cell research. Let's say, Nevada does pulmonary emboluses, and Arizona does brain tumor research or something. I mean, you could imagine that there would be these sort of pet projects, probably reflecting political and economic issues within each one of those states that would come up. And I just think that spending taxpayer money in that kind of haphazard way, when we have a federal system which has worked, and as I said, worked so well in getting the Genome Project funded and done, and producing whatever advances we've had in cancer treatment and so forth, and all these. So, it in some ways it works against it. Now, what I meant by the conflicts in court cases is, I think that there are going to be disputes between the federal government and the states over the kind of infrastructures and oversight of research that the Proposition 71 is suggesting will be created. I think there'll be disputes about whether those investigators can take federal funds in other ways, whether those investigators are adhering properly to, as Marcy has said, to the oversight, the common rule, all the other human subject protections and so forth. And so I think there are going to be disputes in court cases about these issues between state and federal agencies, and over the commercialization issues, and all that mixture is going to end up slowing things down, not speeding things up. I think the fastest way to get to a better situation with embryonic stem cells and with research on embryonic stem cells is to change the administration in Washington. And I don't know why people would want to tamper with a constitution rather than focus on the issue at hand.
May I add to that, Paul? This is Francine. I'd like to give a specific example of mifepristone, which is the drug that's used in the abortion pill, had in fact gone quite far in clinical trials and proving and being tested for cures for cancer. Because it was an abortifacient and used as the abortion pill, we were forced to stop all research having to do with any types of potential use of this potentially very important drug. What would have happened if those of us who were fighting for the right to choice had to try to make an amendment and amend the Constitution to say we have a constitutional right to do research on mifepristone specifically? I mean, there are so many other drugs out there that could give us cures faster than stem cell that for whatever reasons are not being followed up on, and it really is wrong to try to say we're going to go after our own pet drug and give it special recognition and privilege it compared to other different technologies.
Let me just add, this is Paul again. If states want to, through their legislative process, allocate money for a research project or enhance research on a particular one, fine. California is bankrupt, but if the legislature feels that it has the wherewithal and the money to spend on this, fine. But why does it reach the issue of a constitutional amendment? I just don't understand.
This is Deborah Berger. The legislature actually put forward a bill to fund stem cell research,
right.
And the legislature itself said, and it was a modest proposal, I think it was $1 billion, and the legislature itself said we can't afford it, and Schwarzenegger was saying that he wouldn't sign it because we didn't have the budget. So the legislature had already said We can't afford it. So the industry itself, the biotech industry, said, okay, I don't like the answer that mom gave me, so I'm going to go to dad. So they got an initiative on the ballot to get an answer that they wanted. And so it was a way of going through the back door and then appealing to the citizens of California and telling them that this was their last option, this was their last chance to fund stem cell research when the biotech industry itself doesn't need any additional public funding because they've made over $55 billion in profits last year.
Megan, any follow-up to that?
One thing I wanted to talk to Dr. Billings about is, how would, or any of you, how would what money would go in from the state that would, potentially at some point benefit private companies be any different from the process that currently goes on in Washington with the NIH, where there is a constant transfer of basic scientific research into the commercial community that then becomes drugs or treatments? I mean, what difference do you see between what would go on in California and what would go on at the national level that disturbs you?
Well, I think the general point is correct that you're making, which is that we already have a program in which taxpayer money and patent protection, which is conferred by states or by the federal government, provides advantages for commercialization and for the market. In principle, it's not that much different. My particular problem with the Proposition 71 structure is that the benefits are clearly going to be derived by a small group of universities and scientists at those universities who have already, oars in the water, very clearly stakes in the ground. And, in the federal system, while there are favorites and people who are less in favor as well, it's still more diffused, and the public's interest through legislative oversight has to be dealt with. In this system, this is an independent sort of funded entity through bonds, which is going to be benefiting that group and will be very difficult for anyone to curtail if it either becomes worthless or becomes a boondoggle for those folks.
And then, this is Deborah Berger. The thing that I want to add, part of the reason CNA signed on to being against this proposition is that we did not want to see another NIH-type system being set up in the state of California, because we feel that the discoveries from stem cell research should be open sourced, much like computer programming can be open sourced, so that the discoveries would be able to get to the patient sooner. Like with many of the drugs that are being developed or many of the therapies and treatments that are being developed now, if you have money, if you have insurance, you can afford them. If you don't, you can't have them. And it further exacerbates our healthcare system right now. And so we feel that in the United States, there should be a single standard of care that is accessible to everyone. And that's one of the reasons that we actually came out against this initiative, because it further created another system for patenting genetic material that we feel should be open and available for use from everyone.
Okay, we have some questions in the queue, so let's move on.
Beth Whitehouse of Newsday, you may ask your question.
Hi, I wanted to just return briefly to the subject of you believing that women would be asked to donate or give embryos who were not planning to have children. Are you saying there aren't enough eggs that are byproducts of IVF that are happening to sustain this? And if not, what kind of numbers are you thinking of for the women that you feel like will be enticed to do this for no other reason than to just supply embryos to the researchers?
Francine, do you want to take that?
Yes, I'll be happy to. Answer to your first part of your question, no, there definitely are right now sufficient embryos that are frozen and that could be available were we to lift the administrative administration's policies. There's no doubt about that. That's actually part of the problem with how this proposition is written. I mean, it's really clearly been written with the most flexibility possible for the scientists, and leaves the door wide open for creating new embryos if they decide they wish they need to do so. And again, if you read the language of the proposition, every sentence that makes a claim about some kind of oversight then has a qualifier that says it can be modified if to meet the mission of the institute. So that's that issue of why did it feel need to put into this law the fact that it was clearly not only leaving open the gates, but saying that it would allow the creation of new embryos for the sake of research alone is a question that many of us who are concerned about regulations ask. As to how many, your second part of your question, how many we foresee could happen, I wouldn't even venture to guess. What I can say is that we know from, the one study that's been published from Korea, it took, I can't remember, do you remember?
242
embryos to get one successful product. We are talking about generating a need for a tremendous number of embryos, and so the fear that there would be motivation on the part of the researchers and the institute to have to produce mass quantities of these is real.
Just to add to that, we have established safeguards having to do with informed consent that apply to the stored embryos in fertility clinics. When we're talking about somatic cell nuclear transfer or research cloning, that actually poses some unique and really unprecedented risks, and we have to be particularly careful venturing into those areas that we can set up appropriate safeguards, and the market in women's eggs is one piece of that new kind of risk on a scale that we haven't seen to date.
And as was mentioned by the other reporter who asked the question, we see that in the infertility field that whole issue hasn't really been addressed as much as it should be by the safeguards and the regulation. So there's a need for more regulation in this area rather than less.
Any follow-up?
No.
Okay, then we should move on to the next question.
Lauren McCoy of Sacramento Bee, you may ask your question.
You say there's a need for more regulation. Have you all advanced any sort of efforts to bring about regulation outside this initiative regarding the use of eggs in infertility clinics and in experiments?
This is Francine responding. Absolutely. On our committee, the advisory committee that made the recommendations that to make what became California law, the one that says that we would ban human cloning and make therapeutic cloning possible, spent a good part and a good portion of the report focusing on the need for regulation and suggesting ways and models to do so. That is the part that this proposition completely disregards.
Why couldn't the institute adopt those very same regulations? As I understand the initiative, it allows for the institute to come forward with regulations to govern this type of research.
Well, Laura, you're asking a very good question that we've all asked us. As I said, it was a tremendously huge missed opportunity. I do not understand why the authors of this proposition chose to go the route that they did to try to essentially ask the voters. I mean, if you...
But wait a minute. As I understand the initiative, it does not preclude the Institute from doing that. In fact, it asks it to come forth with regulations. Isn't that correct?
No. What it does is it gives the Institute the right to write up their own regulations and says that it should initially start with existing regulations, but has the right to amend in any way, whatever, anything that doesn't fit their mission.
So you are making an assumption this institute will not listen to you and not consider in regulations along the lines that you've suggested?
Well, I'm making an assumption based on experience and history of what happens if you ask somebody to self-regulate. What's ironic is that a lot of the pro-choice Prop 71 folks keep pointing to the fact that we're losing scientists to England because of our laws. What's ironic is in England, in the UK, they have very strict regulations about how this research can be done. They just don't have this ridiculous policy that we have that the Bush administration has put into place. But regulations about how it can be done are very, very strict, much more so than any of us have begun to develop in the United States. But
Deborah Ortiz explained to me that they tried to fund the regulations here in the state and couldn't get the money for it, and that she was hoping that this process would lead to the kind of regulations that are needed for this area. So I guess I'm a little confused as to why you're so convinced that those regulations will not come out of this process.
First of all, Deborah Ortiz is right. She tried to get, as Deborah Berger just mentioned, she did try to put together a request for $1 billion to fund the research, and assuming that there would be regulations along with it. What she didn't get was an approval to spend $1 billion. And the problem with the and Deborah Ortiz is now on record as saying that she's very concerned about the way the Proposition 71 is now written because it lacks the regulations that would have gone along with her proposal.
She just wrote a column supporting the initiative.
She supports the initiative, but has also on record as saying that she's concerned about the lack of oversight that would exist if Proposition 71 does pass.
Laura, this is Marcy Darnowski. I think we have to look at what we can expect from the authors of this proposition. Had they wanted to assure the public and assure voters of their intention to establish good regulatory control, they could have adopted the recommendations of the advisory committee as part of their 29-page initiative. But instead, they've written in loopholes, and they're asking voters to trust them to do it right. Well, maybe they'll do it right, but maybe they won't. And they haven't given us evidence that they intend to. It's not in the initiative itself. On the contrary, the initiative bulletproofs all their activities against any kind of transparency, against any kind of control by the public, against any kind of influence by elected official in multiple ways. So that's the source of the very real concerns about the very real risks that we face here.
I'd like to add to that. This is Francine. I spoke to the authors of the proposition early on and asked that very same question of saying why had they not. Their answer to me was, oh, well, we put that language in because we think that we need even stricter regulations than what are existing. So we put all that language in about modifications so that we could make the regulations even stricter. My answer to them was, well, I have never in my entire life of dealing with regulation seen that one needed to write legalistic language in to allow one to make stricter regulations. You only put that kind of language in if you're wanting to open the door to modifying and easing sanctions or regulations, not to make them stricter.
Thank you.
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Operator?
Once again, to ask a question, please press *1.
Okay, Operator, if there are no more questions in the queue, then I think we can bring this conference to a close, and I want to thank our presenters and thank... Oh, one more question. Operator, can you...
Hi. I just figured I would ask a question, if no one else was. This is a question for Paul Billings. Paul, I mean, this conference call is presented as, sort of liberals, pro-choice liberals, against Proposition 71. I mean, just in hearing you talk and reading some of your writings on stem cells up to this point, I mean, I don't have the sense that you favor embryonic stem cell research just per se outside the context of this proposition. I mean,
No, I want to be really clear about that. I think embryonic stem cells are incredibly interesting from the developmental biology point of view. You know, getting the things that they can, understanding differentiation and tissue and organ formation need embryonic stem cell. I think there's a possibility, I think it's an unlikely possibility, that embryonic stem cells will in fact result in human treatments. I think there's the problem, as I stated, that embryonic stem cells have the tendency to become tumors. That's going to have to be solved before we can do anything in the area. Okay, so that's that. What I do know is that other kinds of stem cells that are easier to get, less controversial, are thrown away every day, are treating people now and have the ability to do many, many things. I think it's very disingenuous of the backers, the scientific backers of 71, to deprecate the research that's going on in adult and cord blood and other kinds of stem cells, because that work is at least as good as the embryonic stem cell work, and and the cells are already in clinical use. So it is not true that I'm that I'm opposed in any fashion to embryonic stem cell research. I am not. I'm really for a balanced view of where the possibilities are now. I think the near-term possibilities far favor work with already used stem cells, and I think the hurdles for embryonic stem cells are substantial, and it's a long shot and a kind of a bet that I just don't think the state of California ought to be making at this time and in this way of funding it and this means and at this size.
May I? This is Francine. I'd like to also add, just in closing, I would like to add to Deborah Berger's plea that the media help make sure that the public knows that there's really a debate here, that there are several sides. So adding to that part, I also we could really, frankly, use help in making clear that it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. This is a myth that the other side is trying to promulgate, that it's either Proposition 71 or we will have missed the boat on taking advantage on possibly getting cures for all of our children's and loved ones' needs. That is false. We have been actually very strongly in California taking leadership and trying to move forward the science. And Proposition 71, frankly, comes along and just completely blindsides all of the work that's being done to do that in a responsible way. But that isn't getting out at all in the media, and the public doesn't know that. All they hear is either for Proposition 71 or you are, you know, don't believe in this research and don't want it going forward.
I think we have time for one more question.
Wendell Harper of KPFA Radio, you may ask your question.
I just wanted to get everybody's full name and what NIH stands for.
NIH, this is Paul. My name is Dr. Paul R. Billings, and NIH stands for National Institutes of Health. And it's the major source of research funding and research federal site for federal research in Bethesda, mostly.
And my name is Francine Cueto.
Spell it, Francine.
Cueytaux. And first name, Francine. Francine.
And Deborah Berger is Deborah Burger. And I'm Marcy Darnovsky, Marcy Darnovsky. And again, thank you everybody for joining us. And please feel free to call our speakers for one-on-one interviews and more information. And Greg Fawcett, 510-306-6307. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.